You're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is part 2 of episode 44, where Tom, Pedro, Ralph and Greta are discussing Oliver E. Williamson's famous article, The Economics of Organization, the Transaction Cost Approach. If you haven't listened to part 1 yet, please go and do so now, as this is a continuation of that discussion. And now, back to the episode.
We've been discussing two articles related to transactional theory of the firm and how knowledge flows within firms. And in this part of the podcast, we're going to talk about how the articles relate to the larger field of organizational science and management theory. The articles in question are Oliver Williamson's The Economics of Organization, The Transaction Cost Approach, and Malone et al.'s follow-on paper, or at least paper that came later, which is about electronic markets, electronic hierarchies, and the implications those things have for business. So we're going to give a brief summary of the articles and then go into where we think they fit in the field of organizational science.
So the transaction cost approach of Williamson and the original article, of course, kind of give us a language to talk about, like, why organizations exist, what are their boundaries, and why are there so many different types of organizations. And kind of what we talked about in part one of the core reasons is asset specificity. And kind of Williamson outlines these three types of asset specificity, of site specificity, the specificity of different technologies and resources you need, and human specificity, the different knowledge and skills that your workers need to have. And in the second article of Malone and colleagues, they kind of argue how information technologies are reducing these transaction costs. And actually, they identify like this fourth type of specificity, as Tom mentioned in part one, that actually time specificity is another one. And new information technologies drastically reduce this.
Yeah, and I think the time specificity is a really interesting one, because it made me think about just-in-time production, the Toyota production system, which is all driven by having the parts show up exactly when you need them to reduce inventory costs. And they do mention that in the Malone article, but that's sort of the thing I was thinking about, in addition to the fresh food and, you know, getting things to markets faster. And I still think it's borderline magic. They can get food at all over the world before it spoils. That's just amazing to me how that works.
So I think it was interesting here, thinking from a more organizational literature perspective, is that similar to what we have discussed in our series about Carnegie Mellon, these two papers very much represent a more economics-based view on organizational issues. And you can see that especially Williamson is trying to go from the more neoclassical approach, a more behavioral one, which is very similar to the things that, you know, people from Carnegie have done as well. And that has eventually led to a broader understanding of the information processing perspective that is explored in Malone, you know, that is thinking about costs and relations and transactions, but not only regarding people and commodities and so on and so forth, but also the very idea of the flow of information in a company. And I think it's interesting to look back, as we have been doing in the part one, of these ideas that have been posed in a more metaphysical way, almost a more ontological or more general model-like propositional way in these texts, and to think more empirically, which is usually our strength, on what does it mean for organizations today, of our idea of boundaries, of our idea of work within organizations and across organizations. You know, maybe so we could explore a bit more on this.
I zeroed in on the model of the efficient boundary in Williamson, and it really made me think a lot about how that plays out in organizations in which I've worked in, and how difficult it is. I mean, a sidecast, which as of this recording is going to be coming out soon. It will already be out by the time we release this episode. Is, you know, it's about efficiency and what efficiency actually means. And even within economics, efficiency means a lot of different things. Setting that aside, I just couldn't help but stare at this diagram and what it's saying about how a firm should be able to logically decide what must be in residence, in source, and what must be outsource, based on different factors such as asset specificity. And the challenge that I had with it is just, and it's more aesthetic than anything else, it's a solid line. I think that that's probably one of the things that makes, you know, why I mentioned before in part one, where there's a lot of perception involved, that if you perceive that something should be in source, that should be in residence within the organization, but another member of the same organization, perhaps another executive or another leader, thinks that it should be outside. And that boundary becomes drawn. Yeah, there's a lot of arbitrariness in terms of where that boundary is going to be drawn. And so while the model of the efficient boundary is easy to explain, makes perfect sense in terms of, yeah, somewhere there's probably some sort of an optimal out there. The notion of, you know, how do you measure transaction costs such that it's better to be inside or outside is very hard to determine, because the cost itself changes over time, does it not? I mean, what we call a transaction cost, the moment that you outsource something, the market changes such that what you just outsourced becomes more and more and more expensive until it makes more sense to bring it back in. That sort of a cycle starts to play.
Well, one of the things I liked was the fact that I think it was Williamson that brought up bounded rationality and the idea that it wasn't just about what perfectly rational actors could do, but what was possible given your understanding and limitations on cognition and that way of seeing that management isn't necessarily omnipotent, or they don't have all this knowledge at hand. There's certain things you can't easily coordinate, which makes you think more about, okay, well, in an ideal world, you could have all this information at your fingertips, or you could have all this great product complexity, but that's not easy for humans to manage. So I personally like the way that he tied that together, tied together the Carnegie Mellon school and the bounded rationality into this, what would otherwise, you know, you might say was a purely economic, you know, look at firms. It actually goes beyond that, which I thought was a good approach.
That is a great example. And I think it's something that we saw already in our last episode about the Carnegie Mellon, the one about organizational learning, in which the problem with these approaches that are very, I would say, model proposition based, and have a more, you know, focus on individual and cognitive aspect. So to go back to what you're saying before, this very idea of bounded rationality, yes, that enables us to capture in more, you know, closer to life aspects of how people decide, but that's still at only a cognitive level. It doesn't account for all the political, and even not necessarily political, you know, meaning power plays, but also the very way that the organization is structured and has different goals and interests. So we can argue that for people in marketing versus people in engineering, in an industrial firm, they're going to perceive the boundaries or the kind of transactions of what should be internalized, what should not be internalized, as different, you know, by the virtue of what you're saying, executive preference or the nature of the work they're doing, the kind of risk the different groups are willing to take, and so on and so forth.
And to add to that, kind of the one thing that's not being discussed is what these boundaries actually are and what happens around it. And that's exactly what you're tapping into here. And kind of the articles talk about it in a way that these boundaries can be objectively measured, can be objectively set. But I think as we're moving into like having firms both offline and online, these boundaries are blurring, and they are more symbolic boundaries than physical boundaries, and that also opens up like more space for ambiguity on how to set those boundaries and what arguments. And one example from my so I did my dissertation research in a Japanese multinational. I did like 2 years of fieldwork in this company. And one of the examples that came to my mind was how, so for one of the R&D projects, they wanted to acquire a spin-off, a university spin-off. They had developed like specific technologies and had some patents, and the researchers knew that they had to acquire the firm to get those patents. They could not work around it. And kind of the headquarter asked the European subsidiary to do a study of why they should acquire this firm and what would be an alternative to that. And so they did the study, and kind of the outcome was, yes, we have to acquire it. And then the headquarter asked them to do another study, and to do another study. And kind of, they, so what is the proof that you have come to a proper assessment of your decision to acquire this firm? And I think that kind of illustrates like the maybe the politics that go about it, like the decision-making process, and kind of how can you, how as a firm can you decide like this is the best solution for us? And our opinion is this is more a subjective thing and has more to do with rhetorics and having a convincing narrative rather than objective facts.
I was going to say that when I look at boundary, can appear to be symbolic. I almost look at it as through an institutional lens. Like the boundary or the formation of the boundary as an institution unto itself. And I'm sort of using Richard Scott's three pillars of institution. We in the U.S. federal government do have a very formal process or a formal metric in which we make determination that certain things are called inherently governmental or not. So you do have some legal frameworks that determine part of the boundary, say, between what the government considers to be, required to be handled by federal personnel versus what is allowed to be outsourced. Yes, that boundary can, of course, shift. Then a lot of what we're talking about is, in addition to that, there's also some of the normative and the shared understandings of where the boundary should be that sort of come into play that cause the boundary to be a little bit more mobile for those things that are not formally designated or legislated.
I love the way that Tom focuses on those boundaries aren't really hard. And in fact, a lot of them are determined by executive preference as opposed to, this is exactly where we should build a building or have the wall. And therefore those boundaries not only change because the executives make different decisions, but as Tom rightly pointed out, they also change because the technology and the markets change, because other firms come up with, different ideas or you have these challenges coordinating information. I mean, I've seen many times in the work I did in the Navy where the organizations were strongly encouraged or felt a strong imperative to bring as much inside as possible so they could reduce their transaction costs of having to deal with other suppliers or other people doing the work because it made it more difficult for them. So you could see why, so that's one of the imperatives in shipyards is control as much of the work as possible. Even though for an external customer, it was like, it's really expensive when you do that, and it often is. But when you look at the product overall being delayed, that, that's crazy expensive in shipyards. So it might be actually better to suboptimize some of the individual transaction costs to get a better total result. So that's, I don't think the article really addresses that.
That's a great example. And now I think I can, it brought me to my mind again, the issue of the hard line in the image of the boundary, because what I am understanding what you're saying, Tom, is that depending on the issue at hand, depending on the organizational process, or even maybe the task, it might involve different people, and there might be different layers of permeability in the boundary or not. So it's not like there is one hard line around the organization, but depending on the department that's dealing with this thing or dealing with a specific task, there are going to be I don't know how to say it visually, but almost like a multi-layered kind of thing.
That's a great point, Pedro, that these political aspects and different people in the organization, not just different executives, right, but depending on what your function is, will likely see the boundaries different. That's a great observation.
Yeah, I think that what that illustrates is that the boundary, I mean, if we were to actually draw the boundary, trying to play off of Pedro's model, I would look at the boundary as almost like a patchwork. It's sort of the accumulation of decisions over time. Because you're absolutely right, Ralph. Like, when these decisions are made about whether something is inside or outside the boundary, although, you know, people try to apply a logic to it, it's still very heavily contextualized. And it's oriented on the particular problem you're trying to solve at that given time. So if you were to try to draw the boundary as a nice clean line, it wouldn't work that way. It is basically the accumulation of decisions prior. And certainly inefficiencies are going to creep up when you do that, which means then you accumulate more changes.
I completely agree. And like, there are two things we can talk about. And the first one, which we didn't tap into in part one, but it's kind of in the last section of Williamson's article, he kind of tries to apply this transaction cost thinking to issues of managing workers and considering like different employment relations. And he kind of makes this distinction between basically, he identifies these two dimensions of work, and that's like the firm specificity of the work and the skills and resources that workers need to have and the amount of learning that goes into doing their job well. And the other thing is how easy it is to evaluate the performance of an individual worker. And based upon these two dimensions, he has his 2x2 model. He you can look it up in his on page 566. He has this figure where he distinguishes four different types of workers in your organization, and he talks about like internal spot markets. And here he talks about like he uses the language human assets, but let's say we're talking about workers that have like non-specific knowledge and skills, and they're performance is very easy to evaluate. And then he says, like, well, then you can easily replace these people when they don't perform well. So you don't need a specific structure or employment relation to sustain this relation with the worker. And the second group of workers he's talking about are these primitive teams. So, well, there's not really specificity in their knowledge or in their skills. It's difficult to evaluate the performance of an individual, but you can assess the outcomes of the team. So the team might continue to exist and do their work, but you can change the members. So that's kind of the second group. And then he says, like, well, because you can easily change the team membership, you also don't need a traditional employment relation for those type of workers. And then the third one, he calls obligational markets. Don't bother me about these terms. I think they're weird. But anyway, what he talks about is this group of people that have like their knowledge and skills are firm specific. There has been amount of learning into doing their job well, and it's easy to evaluate individual performance. And that's where he says like, both the firm and the worker have invested in this relation, and there's an interest in maintaining this, the continuity of that relation. So that's where the traditional employment relationship comes into play. And then going to the fourth one to finish it off, he talks about these relational teams. So he realized like not all the work is done individually. We also have teams, and they not only have like this firm-specific learning happening, but also it's you can evaluate the performance of the team, but not the performance of the individual. And that's where he says, like, you should keep those employees together and provide them with considerable, like, job security.
So I think it's very interesting to think about employment for two reasons. I think first, traditionally, you know, with studies of organization, if you think about people like Goldner in the 50s, 60s, 60s in the case of Goldner, there was still kind of an overlap between people that were interested in studying organizations and work and also labor. And, you know, if you go back all the way to Weber, the whole idea of bureaucracy and so on and so forth is as much as an organizational form, as a form of employment. And this today we tend to discuss one or the other. So there are people that are more interested in labor relations, and we have, you know, people that study organizations and work. So it's interesting to see how it's important to understand employment, to understand issues related to work and organizational forms as well. Because as you all were actually discussing before, we think about the boundaries and we think about the different relations that exist with the outside, so to speak. And you can have one that is an outsourcing from a firm to a firm. But, you know, Ralph was bringing the example that sometimes you can bring an expert to inside the firm. And we have the case of online labor markets that you study, Greta. That's exactly the firm dealing with an intermediary and almost like sometimes an intermediary that is really close to the individual. So it's almost like an atomization of the relation. So it's firm to individual. So I think that's nowadays, interestingly, is even more important to think about that because it seems to be, you know, phenomena is emerging more and more.
Exactly. And that kind of brings me to like the second point I wanted to bring up. And that's like kind of the Williamson article is a one moment in time assessment, kind of a stable, like you can have an objective assessment of where you should set your boundaries and where it's most efficient for your type of firm. But kind of the Malone article makes us realize that context change, technologies change, and there's a continuous re-evaluation of where we set firm boundaries and how we organize economic activity, the production of goods and services, and the labor, the work that goes into that, and the way we organize that. And I think like the Williamson framework, applying it to the employment relationship, gives us a framework of thinking. And kind of what we see now is in the past 20 years, like we have seen like the rise of the staffing industry, the rise of the outsourcing industry. And that all started off with like outsourcing, offshoring, low skilled labor, non-firm specific labor, things that were cheaper to do outside rather than inside. But as we moved on, we've also seen like the outsourcing of innovation, of more skilled labor that Williamson never thought would happen, because he said you want to keep that knowledge inside the firm. You want to maintain that relationship with the worker because you're both invested in it. And it's expensive to find a new employee that can do that job. And as we see now, like you talked about like the rise of the gig economy and as you say, like the atomization of work, work becoming like changing from a job role to more project based towards more task based. And we see like the development of online labor platforms, for instance, like Microwork, Amazon Mechanical Turk, which is really piecemeal work, like, coding one image, which is like a few seconds, and you would get like $1 per minute, or I don't know exactly what the prices are there, but you also have like the higher end of this new types of intermediaries emerging online labor markets for knowledge work, like online freelancing platforms. I'm thinking of, for instance, Catalans offering professional services. I'm thinking of Upwork, which is well known for software and mobile development, but also other categories of work. And for instance, freelancer.com, where we really have these independent freelancers that are very specialized, they're very skilled. And some of them are so specialized, it's difficult to find an interesting job within one firm. And so they decide to become a freelancer so they can work for different firms and even making more money. So we kind of see like from a firm perspective and from a worker perspective, over time, we continuously evaluate how we would like to organize work. How we would like to do work, and like digital technologies is one cause that makes that this changes. But for instance, the institutional context where we talked about briefly is another important one, like the way we organize benefits, which is now mostly organized through firms.
It's ironic that the world has become more atomistic and individualized than the economists could have predicted.
I think the interesting things we've been observing about this literature and how it relates to other forms of organizational science, research, and management science is that, yes, the authors were able to predict all sorts of interesting trends and things that we are seeing today, but I think all of us has observed in our own way that they're leaving parts out, that there's aspects of what they predicted that are even further broken down into small pieces, or you can't exactly treat the workers like they're just this replaceable asset that are interchangeable. You know, you're seeing that with Uber drivers and Deliveroo and some of those kinds of things in larger cities, where the workers are actually organizing external to the entity that's employing them. So I think those are limitations of any articles that are 30 years old. But what strikes me is how much they got right and how much you can learn by looking at transaction costs. I don't think the authors were saying it's the only thing, but you can predict a lot of stuff from that.
And that's all for part two. Thank you for listening. If you're enjoying the discussion, please let your friends, colleagues, and students know about the podcast and the episode, and we look forward to welcoming you to part three next week here on Talking About Organizations.